The mission in Afghanistan? Security.
Nothing's gonna harm you, not while I'm around.
Security has been a success, led by the Afghan National Security Forces, supported by ISAF. I was also impressed by the courage of the Afghans.
That sense of calm during the September elections has given way to violence and insecurity today, despite NATO and ISAF forces. Afghanistan in harm's way. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 29th. I'm Celeste Headlee. John Hockenberry is out sick today. Coming up, the House leadership unveils its health care bill today, but nobody knows what's in that bill, not even the House members who have to vote on it. We're going to get the details from Todd Zwillick, and we're going to go to Appalachia, where environmentalists and coal miners are not getting along. I realize that's a surprise, but we'll hear details about that, too. And we'll talk about values and how people's priorities change when money is tight. But first, we go to Sarah Chase, advisor to the NATO military command in Kabul, Afghanistan. Sarah, you've lived in Afghanistan for years. A Taliban attack that targeted a guest house in Kabul yesterday killed 8 people, civilians. So what does it feel like living there as a civilian after that attack?
Well, as you pointed out, I've been here for a while, and I've been seeing things, I have to say, deteriorate gradually. And in fact, I spent most of my time in the south, where the conditions are significantly worse, actually, than they are in Kabul. So I have to say it's a little bit of the situation of the frog and the slowly warming water. I don't feel very different today than I did a couple of days ago.
Sarah Chase, stay with us. We're going to talk to you more in just a few minutes. But first, everything else you need to know this morning. In the headlines, President Obama made a surprise midnight visit to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. He was there to pay his respects to the bodies of 18 U.S. service members who died in Afghanistan this week. Staying in Afghanistan, the Washington Post reports this morning that President Obama has requested a study to determine which Afghan provinces need the most international help. The president continues to consider whether troop increases are needed there. Here in the House, here in the U.S., House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is expected to unveil the latest version of the House health care bill today. That comes after months of negotiations on merging 3 separate House bills. A vote in the full chamber of the House could be held by the end of this week. That's separate from the bill that's forming in the Senate. The latest GDP estimate is due out this hour. It's expected to tell us if the U.S. is still in recession or in recovery. We're also going to learn the number of people who applied for unemployment benefits last week. And in sports, the Philadelphia Phillies won Game 1 of the World Series, beating the New York Yankees 6-1. Almost a rout there in last night. Game 2 is tonight. Rough day, not just in the ballpark, but on Wall Street yesterday. The Dow fell more than 1% to close at 97.63. The S&P slid 2% down to 10.43. And the NASDAQ down almost 3% to 20.60. The economy is recovering, partly because businesses are able to get their work done with fewer labor costs. Are you having to work more hours to make up for people who've been laid off?
This is Sherry. I work for one of the big 4 accounting firms. About 15% of my department was laid off, and we're all now expected to work 15% mandatory unpaid overtime.
Mandatory unpaid overtime. Is that you? Tell us at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Good morning. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's arrival in South Asia was met by deadly Taliban attacks in both Pakistan and Afghanistan yesterday. In Pakistan, a car bomb tore through a congested market in the northwest city of Peshawar, killing more than 100 people. It was one of the deadliest attacks in Pakistan in 2 years. Here's Hillary Clinton responding at a news conference yesterday.
These attacks on innocent people are cowardly. They are not courageous. They are cowardly.
And over in Kabul, Afghanistan, at least 5 people working for the United Nations along with 3 others were killed after gunmen stormed a guest house in the city in the capital of Afghanistan. We'll look now at how civilians on the ground are feeling after an attack so close to where they live. We spoke earlier this morning to Sarah Chase. She works with the NATO in Afghanistan. Sarah, can you describe to us what it's like to be in Kabul right now? Many people actually say that Kabul's relatively feels like a normal big city.
You know, it does, and there's a lot of life and, you know, bustle in the market took place. It's an extremely congested city. There's a lot of traffic, and it's really, I guess, a tribute to Afghans. It's kind of terrible, but Afghans' acclimatization to violence. I mean, this is a society that recovers very quickly when, you know, you have something terrible happen, and people move on, and they move on because they have to, because they really don't have a choice. They've got to, you know, get across town. They have to purchase what they need to eat this evening and things like that. And so on the one hand, there's a kind of people are pushed by necessity. And secondly, there is a kind of numbing, I think, to a certain level of violence.
You're working for NATO there, but in a civilian capacity. And this attack, this recent attack, focused, targeted specifically civilians. So how did you react when you heard that? Was that a different reaction than when they target military targets?
Again, I mean, because I've spent a lot of time in Kandahar in the south, where it is true that international civilians haven't been targeted, obviously, to the same extent that military personnel have, but I live among Afghans in Kandahar, and those are the people who are really being targeted. I mean, the people who really are in danger right now are Afghans who are involved in any way, either with the government of Afghanistan, with members of the international community. And because I live side by side with those Afghans, my sense of the level of risk is much higher, I think, than many other international civilians who live a more isolated life.
We've heard supposedly messages from the Taliban saying that these attacks are meant to keep people from going to the elections, from participating in the upcoming November runoff election. Do you get the sense there that is a tactic that's working? Are people feeling more nervous and feeling like they need to stay home?
But that was very effective in the first round. And again, I was down in Kandahar for the first round of the elections, and attacks were almost unnecessary. There was such a high level of intimidation, and especially since down in the south there are areas that are effectively under Taliban control, most people really in Kandahar province didn't go to vote because they were told not to. The warning was sufficient. I would say what's interesting and distressing about attacks like yesterday's is that they're very well calibrated to have a psychological effect. This is not mass violence. This is it doesn't compare to Baghdad, for example, in the very bad days. It's quite carefully calibrated psychological operations. And so the impact, and again, particularly on the Afghan population, is quite significant because it's a traumatized population. You don't have to have rivers of blood in Afghanistan to actually affect people's perceptions. And so this really is a war of perception at the moment, and thinking carefully about where Afghans are psychologically and how to help relieve some of the psychological pressure is almost as important as material security protection.
Well, please stay safe, Sarah. That's Sarah Chase, advisor to the NATO military command in Kabul. Thanks. We're joined now by Ferry Doon. He's a 25-year-old law student at Cardin University in Kabul. We're not using his last name for security reasons. And we're also going to hear from Michael Semple, a regional specialist focusing on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Semple's a fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard. Good morning. Ferry Doon, you heard what Sarah Chase just said about the atmosphere in Kabul, and I'm wondering, do you agree with her on are people feeling that nervous about the civilian attacks in Kabul, that perhaps the city is not secure at this point?
I think she's right, and she said that life becomes normal due to necessities of the people. That's very true. People are feeling nervous with the growing attacks and Taliban warning that they're going to increase their attacks and not let people go to vote. So it is becoming a big worry to the people. But on the other side, once all these attacks happen, and then we go out, like today, I'm an event chair, which is for skating. People then suddenly are motivated and look to the future and try to forget what has happened, the bad thing that has happened. Yesterday, while the attack happened, I was on my way to the office, and we are very close to the place where the attack happened. I was very worried for my friends and my colleagues who are working there, and that worry was totally driving me insane because you never know if your friends are caught in the middle of this whole situation. So it is a worry for the people, not only foreigners, but Afghans are also targeted. National police, national army is being targeted, and guards are being targeted who are working for the international organizations.
That's Ferry Doon. He's a 25-year-old law student at Cardin University in Kabul, Afghanistan. Michael Semple joins us from Boston. Good morning, Michael. This strategy of this targeted, very specifically targeted attack on civilians in Kabul, we've seen the Taliban do that kind of thing in places, as Sarah said, like Kandahar. This is the first time they've used this tactic in Kabul. Is this a ramping up?
Unfortunately, it's not the first time that they have attacked civilian targets in Kabul, but it's the first time that they've got international headlines for going after the civilian side of the UN. They have routinely been attacking civilian Afghan government targets, but it doesn't catch quite as much media attention as going after the UN does.
So maybe that's why they attacked the UN.
Absolutely. They have decided to go for a high-profile target to try and undermine the will to resist both in the international community and in the Afghan body politic.
And do we expect that this is going to work, that it will keep people away from the polls? Because as we know, in the September elections, people still went and voted. They were afraid, but people still turned up at the polls. Do we expect the same thing to happen here in November?
Well, in a sense, the country is already sort of divided into areas which are under the sway of the Taliban and areas which are sort of part of the government system where there is some residual government influence. It's between the south and the north, between the city and the countryside, and this will worry people everywhere. But you can still expect that those who belong to the non-Taliban system, parts of the north and the center of the country, the areas around the towns, they will still turn out to vote.
You know, these kind of attacks don't require a lot of resources on the part of the Taliban. They require, the three attackers died as well. They require people who are willing to go in and die, whether with a bomb or a gun attack. And I'm wondering, is there any way to prevent this kind of thing? Is there any way even to fight this?
The reality is that there is going to be the risk of this kind of attack going on for a long time. Afghanistan is a problem which is not going to be solved anytime soon. You can turn the challenge upside down as well. For the Taliban, there's a certain economy of effort. It doesn't cost them more than a few people prepared to die. On the other hand, it perhaps doesn't achieve a great deal. If their aim is to take over the country, they are not going to take over the country by blowing up guest houses, because in between 1994 and 1996, the Taliban swept across southern Afghanistan. They captured half the country, most of the Pashtun areas, in a two-year period, and then went on to rule the country from Kabul. They've been fighting like this for going on 8 years now and have not managed to take over a single major administrative center. And this kind of attack, of course, wins them no territory.
And that sounds like that's the takeaway here. If the United States feels like it hasn't made a lot of progress, well, really, the Taliban's been fighting for 8 years, and they haven't made much progress either. Michael Semple's a regional specialist focusing on Afghanistan and Pakistan. He's also a fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard. He joins us from Boston, Massachusetts. We are asking you all day today about your job, by the way. Many people are working longer hours. They're having to pick up a lot of extra responsibilities because businesses have laid off their colleagues. Is that you? Or maybe you're one of these bosses that's having to ask more of your employees. Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now for some takeouts on stories we're following all this week. We're going to go first to Washington. Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Todd, after weeks of talking about how they're going to reconcile the three versions of the House Democrats' healthcare overhaul, after weeks of back and forth on robust public option, a mild public option, they're finally getting ready to release it. What is it?
Yeah, that's right. The House Democratic leadership, Celeste, plans to
unveil their big healthcare bill this morning on the steps of the Capitol, you know, holding a big event. We don't know a ton about what's in this bill because they absolutely will not share it. Not last night and not this morning. We know a couple of things. The public option is not the robust public option that Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic leadership said they wanted. It's a public option based on negotiated rates. So that means it's not based on Medicare. It's based on the government negotiating, just like insurance companies do now, with doctors and hospitals. And that saves some money, but it, according to the Congressional Budget Office, it saves about $85 billion less than if you did it based on Medicare, and actually covers fewer people because it's not as cheap.
$85 billion between friends, right?
Well, $85 billion to the Congress over 10 years. Yeah, that's money the progressives and a lot of Democrats would have wanted for coverage and to pay for other things. We also know that the bill is paid for in part by a surtax on individuals making more than $500,000 a year, families making more than $1 million.
So what is the reaction from other Democrats? Are we hearing anything from the liberals in the House? Are they upset about getting rid of the robust public option? From the more conservative Democrats? Have they reacted?
The liberals will be a little bit upset. This is an interesting reaction from a Congressman Marion Barry from Arkansas, who happens to be a pharmacist, an enemy of the insurance companies and the drug companies, and talked a little bit last night. He came out of a meeting with Nancy Pelosi yesterday evening and talked about his old nemesis, Billy Tozan, who was a longtime powerful congressman, chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, who, within a year of leaving Congress in 2005, became the president of Pharma, which is the big lobbying arm of the drug industry. Listen to Marion Barry.
I don't think we're getting near enough out of the drug companies and the insurance companies. I don't know the details, and maybe they've done better than I think, but if they're not squealing to the high heavens, we hadn't hit them hard enough. You know, if Billy Tozan sleeps tonight, we hadn't done enough.
His old nemesis, Billy Tozan, there.
Right, which I am assuming we will hear reaction from Pharma soon after. But so we don't really have an idea. It doesn't even sound like he has an idea of how stringent this health care bill is.
Well, and no, and it was interesting that he was asked to appear with, he and many, many Democrats were asked to appear with the speaker this morning on camera. They don't even know if they support the bill yet, so that's a choice a member of Congress has to make.
It's an interesting state of affairs.
It is. You asked about the progressives. You want to hear about them real quick?
Real quick.
Lynn Woolsey is head of the Progressive Caucus. They are heading up to meet with the president today because they wanted the robust public option and had said earlier that they will only lend their 80 or so votes, their voting bloc, to the robust public option. They're not going to get it. So here's what Woolsey had to say yesterday.
We will be looking at the words of the legislation. We will be insisting on it being as strong as it can possibly be. And if it isn't, then we will look at whether we support it or not.
Well, if nothing else, at least we can console ourselves that we know just as much as they do, which is nothing. Todd Zwillick is the Takeaways Washington correspondent.
We know a little.
Thanks, Todd. Now let's go to business with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, The New York Times. And Louise, help me out here because this is a little confusing. We heard that in August home sales went up, and that was great news.
Right.
But now we get the numbers from Case Shiller, another analyst, and they say home sales fell in September.
So there are a lot of measures out there. Case-Shiller came out a couple of days ago about August and said they went up. And yesterday we got these government numbers that showed them falling 3.6%. It's a little bit like shaking the magic eight ball. You keep getting a different answer. It's not consistent. And so actually, I'm a bit concerned because...
With these new numbers, because
what we're seeing is a fear among home buyers that this government tax credit is going to end, because if you don't close the deal,
this $8,000 tax credit for new home buyers
has really propped up the market, and it's set to end by November 30th. And if your transaction hasn't closed by then, you don't get it. And in the last month, a lot of people think home buyers said, oh, well, I can't get a deal to close by November 30th. Forget it. And I kind of think about it like, you know, I do a lot of rock climbing.
Yeah.
And when you rock climb, your partner holds a rope. And if you get to hard move, they can kind of pull up on the rope to make it easier for you.
Right.
And I think the government is holding a giant rope on this housing market with artificially low housing rates, as well as these tax credits, which now they're saying they're going to extend them till next summer. And I want to know, what's going to happen when the government lets go of this rope? Because I'm afraid the housing market might really fall off that cliff again.
Well, I'm assuming that they're hoping that by the time April deadline comes around, that the economy will have rebounded a bit.
That is what they're hoping. And certainly, you know, today we have numbers coming out from the Commerce Department on the growth of the economy. And a lot of economists think that we're going to see the economy start to grow again, which will be a very big deal. But unemployment's not changing, and people still don't have jobs. And if that doesn't change, I don't see the housing market getting much better.
Okay, that's not very good news, Louise. Tomorrow we'll have to think of something happy.
Okay, I'll think.
Louise Storm is the finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. And our last takeout comes from you, our listeners. We talked yesterday about how even haters can love okra, but Troy in North Dakota called us.
Forget about okra. Find me a way to not hate Brussels sprouts. I can honestly say Brussels sprouts are the one vegetable that I would consent to eat only at gunpoint.
We also got this tongue-in-cheek email from Theodora. She writes, I thought you said you were going to take away my fear of the Oprah, which is fascinating because I realize the similarity, she writes. Both have African roots. You can get either one pretty much everywhere. Some people think it takes over things. So, Theodora, listen, okra is O-K-R-A, and Oprah, the talk show host, is O-P-R-A-H, totally spelled differently. However, the similarities you point out, you make a good point. Anyway, we also talked yesterday about a bit of a gender war happening on our website. We read a comment from Katya who said, not all women are obsessed with cleanliness. Well, Katya wrote to us again. She writes, I'm definitely one of those women who breaks the stereotype. I do tend to be the one who breaks out the vacuum to do battle with the dust bunny battalions, but my partner is always lamenting my messiness, not that he's perfect either, and I think the junk mail looks good decorating the table. And Melanie emails, I'm a slob and my husband is obsessively neat, although I am improving with age. And yes, women can be messy too. One of our listeners was called to move to call us over a mention we made, well, I made, about Detroit with our sports commentator, contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
Detroit is improving every week, whereas the Redskins are not improving every week. So I would say that they're one of the most inept franchises.
You hear that, Detroit? Detroit is not the word. And so we got this response from Tom.
I always think that loving Detroit is like loving a porcupine or loving a cactus. Both are good.
8778-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Good morning. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about the battle for environmentalists. Can we protect the environment and protect jobs? I don't know. We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, let's check in with Femi Okeh on some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes past the hour.
Good morning, everybody. President Obama arrived for a surprise visit at the Dover Air Force Base in Delaware last night. And that's the sound of a military honor guard coming to attention as President Obama saluted in Dover. He was watching the coffins of 18 American service members being unloaded off a military plane. They died earlier this week in Afghanistan. In healthcare news, House Democrats are set to unveil a revised version of their healthcare overhaul later today. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says that she wants to get the measure to the House floor next week with a final vote before mid-November. Overseas, Iraq is calling for more support from the United States to combat suicide bombings. Several attacks on Sunday killed more than 150 people there. The Iraqi government says those attacks reinforce the need for more U.S. commitment. And staying in the region, the government in Iran has said that there's been, I'm going to quote them here, a shift from confrontation to cooperation, end of quote, in the West's attitude to Iran's nuclear program. The UN has proposed a package of measures that include Iran sending uranium abroad for enrichment. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
And we're just learning that the economy now has grown at 3.5% pace in the third quarter. That's the best rate in 2 years, and it signals officially the end of the recession. Of the energy in our country, you may not know this, it comes from coal, and a lot of that coal is mined in West Virginia, where the debate over coal and climate change sometimes gets a little bit ugly.
And the reason that this committee is being used is because it takes the people out of the process.
That's the sound of an environmentalist at a public hearing in West Virginia this month, hearing about federal environmental regulations, and she was getting booed by coal industry supporters in the crowd. The Obama administration this month is threatened to block what would be the largest surface mine in the state, and that's really heated up the debate about whether you need to protect jobs or protect the environment. We're joined now by Roger Horton. He works at Mountaintop Mine as a truck driver. He's the founder of the group Citizens for Coal. He joins us from Holden, West Virginia. And also Erica Peterson is a reporter at West Virginia Public Radio. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Roger, you heard that exchange between the environmentalist and the boos in the crowd. And I'm wondering, what is at stake here that's making people so passionate about this? Why are people so upset?
Well, the crux of the whole issue has to do with the ability to provide your family with a quality of living. Our mining jobs give us the ability to provide our families with a good standard of living, to provide us with good health care, and to help grow our economy. It's that simple.
What would happen to your, let's say that this mining project were shut down because of environmental regulations, what would happen to the town where you live?
Well, it would fall apart, and that's the absolute truth. The entire area where I live, it's built and supported by the coal mining industry. For every coal mining job, there are some, say, five or six related jobs who support that miner's job. So it's a tremendous amount of profit that has been put into this area to keep the people working. And without that, our schools are going to suffer, our hospitals would suffer. It would just be negative all the way around.
Erica Peterson, your reporter at West Virginia Public Radio. We got inklings earlier this year in the spring that the Obama administration planned to look at some of these mining permits more closely. Why are they threatening to block this particular project?
Well, they've kind of been taking baby steps since March, threatening that they were going to scrutinize mountaintop removal a lot more carefully. So they've, been taking these little steps, and this blockage, this threat to veto the spruce mine permit, is kind of the most concrete step they've taken. Environmentalists have been complaining that their plans don't really have a lot of details until now. But this mine has been kind of embroiled in litigation for more than a decade, so people, for a lot of people, it's coming out of nowhere, but people have been fighting this mine for a really long time now.
Well, we should be clear on what kind of mining we're talking about. We're not talking about people digging tunnels into the ground and pulling coal out. Mountaintop mining, they're removing the mountaintop.
Yeah, usually when you go underground to reach the mine, it's because there are really thick seams of coal that you can reach by going underground. But when there are thinner seams that are closer to the surface, you can reach them by going from the top down. And so you take, the top of the mountain and basically move it to get at the coal.
Roger Horton, you've worked for a long time as a truck driver for a mountaintop mine. Do you feel like we have to make this choice? Is it a choice between jobs and the environment?
No, absolutely not. There's a very small percentage of those who have brought this to the public's attention by negative consequences. If you comply with the law and do the things that the EPA, our state DEP, tell you to do, and you mitigate any unnecessary steps that could cause some environmental consequences, everything could be done fine. We do that. It's been a very small amount of those people who do not take the necessary time and steps to do the things properly that has brought this to light.
You're the founder of the group Citizens for Coal, and I understand that the goal of that organization is to create a dialogue between environmentalists and the coal industry, your workers, your union workers. But you heard that the clip of tape earlier is the booing and the telling someone to turn their power off. Is that the kind of dialogue that you're fostering?
No, it is absolutely not the type of dialogue that I'm fostering. And you can clearly hear how passionate these people are about their jobs and how much they want to keep them. You know, when someone from afar or even locally tries to shut your job down, say someone comes to your radio station and they say that your radio station is not an environmentally friendly operation, you're going to fight those people and you're going to do everything you can possibly do to keep your job. That's exactly what's occurring.
Okay, Erica, you said this has been embroiled in legislation for a long time, and it looks like it's going to be held up for a little while longer. When can we expect a final decision from the Obama administration?
They really don't know. They've got they had their public comment period. Now they've got to think about it for a while. I think I've heard sometime next year.
Erica Peterson is a reporter at West Virginia Public Radio. We were also joined by Roger Horton from West Virginia. He works at a mountaintop mine as a truck driver and is founder of Citizens for Coal. Coming up, what kind of trip is worth scrimping and saving and sacrificing so you can get $13,000 in the bank to pay for it? We're going to talk about your values and whether or not they're changing with the economy in just a few moments. In the meantime, we're asking you to call and tell us what's changed at your job with all the people laid off, all the millions of unemployed people. Are you having to work extra hours at your office to make up for the colleagues who've been laid off? Or are you an employer asking your employees to work extra hours? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. The next story, you might say, is a journey from the fringe to the very center of power on Capitol Hill. Democratic Congressman, the thing that everybody used to know about Democratic Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts is that he was the first openly gay member of Congress. But today, we know a lot more about Barney Frank than just that. He has completely rewritten the nation's financial regulations in the midst of very troubled economic times. Author Stuart Weisman joins us now. He has a new biography of Barney Frank out, and the title says it all. Barney Frank, the story of America's only left-handed gay Jewish congressman. He came up with this title himself, you said.
No, I came up with the title. It comes from a phrase that Barney Frank used in 1995 after the Republicans had taken control of Congress. Newt Gingrich was elected speaker. A New York Times reporter asked Barney how life was in the minority. And Barney said, I'm used to being in the minority. I'm a left-handed gay Jew.
So when you first started writing this book 5 years ago, Barney Frank was not as powerful as he is today.
No, actually, Barney's assumption was that if he stayed in Congress long enough, he would become chairman of the Judiciary Committee, not Financial Services. That was because there was only one person in front of him, John Conyers, for Judiciary, who was much older. There were three younger members in front of him for seniority as the ranking Democrat on Financial Services. One of them, Chuck Schumer, moved over to the Senate. Another one died, and a third one got redistricted, and that's how Barney rose on the Financial Services Committee.
Okay, so when Barney first started in Congress, we actually didn't hear a lot of sound bites from him, but many people recognize this, Barney.
On what planet do you spend most of your time? It is a tribute to the First Amendment that this kind of vile, contemptible nonsense is so freely propagated. Jim, trying to have a conversation with you would be like trying to argue with a dining room table. I have no interest in doing it.
Okay, so has being in Congress and handling all this power made him more cranky? Has it made him more loud and rambunctious?
No, I don't think so. I think that has been part of Barney's career, dating back to his days in the Massachusetts State Legislature in the 1970s.
He was more so? Has he changed at all, or he's just always been... Barney Frank we know today.
He was even more unfettered when he was in the state legislature. And I'll give you an example. In 1974, Barney had introduced a bill to implement the recommendations of the President's Commission on Marijuana. And a conservative Democrat rose on the floor and took direct aim at Barney Frank, commenting that Frank had introduced legislation to promote prostitution, pornography, smut, adultery, gambling, rights for homosexuals, and now this bill decriminalizing marijuana. And he said, Mr. Speaker, when is Frank going to stop? That the representative asked very indignantly. Barney Frank rose up and said, I want to assure my colleague that I will keep trying until I find something that he likes to do.
Your new book is called Barney Frank, the Story of America's Only Left-Handed Gay Jewish Congressman. I assume that claim is still true.
It's still true. Actually, when I came up with that title in June of 2008.
There's one other, but he's ambidextrous.
It turns out that he is.
Okay, yeah. Stuart Weisberg is the author of the new Barney Frank book. It's on bookstore shelves now. Yeah. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley. John Hackenberry is out sick today. Coming up, our friend Farai Chidea will join us for more in her series on values. When money is tight, what starts to have more value for you than cash? We're going to talk about that just in a moment. But we're also talking about your job and the economy. And if people have been laid off at your work, are you then working more hours to make up for it?
I'm Kristen from Kutztown, New Jersey. I teach in Flanders, New Jersey, and it may not be an area of the economy that you would consider in a discussion like this, but this year I have anywhere between 28 and 30 students in every class, each high school. And that's a direct result of our budget failing, which resulted in layoffs for a lot of teachers and aides.
That is exactly the kind of story that we are looking for, actually. Tell us your story at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. First, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour with Femi Okay.
Hello there. It is official. The U.S. is out of the recession and is now in a phase of recovery. New GDP estimates just out this morning say the economy grew at 3.5% in the third quarter, and that's the best showing in 2 years. We also just learned that the number of people who applied for unemployment benefits last week, it's 530,000, fewer than analysts expected, and down from last week. Overseas, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is welcoming what he's describing as a shift from confrontation to cooperation in the West's attitude to Iran's nuclear program. Caroline Hawley, correspondent for our partner, the BBC, has more.
After years of growing tension over Iran's nuclear program, President Ahmadinejad today said Iran was ready for cooperation. But he also said Iran's nuclear rights were inalienable. And many question what kind of cooperation the country is ready for. Iran has been giving out mixed messages over an important nuclear deal drafted by the UN. It calls for Iran to send the vast bulk of its enriched uranium out of the country for further processing in Russia and France. That would ensure Iran gets fuel for its reactor, while allaying Western concerns about the country developing a nuclear bomb, because it would temporarily reduce Iran's uranium stockpiles. A formal response from the Iranian authorities is expected later today, but there are indications that Iran might only agree to send out its uranium in batches. One newspaper says it also wants a simultaneous exchange of uranium and fuel. It's unclear what reaction such a conditional Iranian response to the deal would get.
And that's Caroline Hawley, correspondent for our partner at the BBC. Back in the US, in healthcare news, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is expected to unveil the latest version of the House bill today. This comes after months of negotiations on merging three separate House bills. A vote in the full chamber could be held by the end of next week, and this is separate from the bill forming in the Senate. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
We're joined again today by our friend Farai Chidea. She's working on a series that we're calling The Value, and it's about how people's priorities are changing in this uncertain economy. So what do you have for us today, Farai?
Well, I spoke with a guy named Mason Scherzer. He is what you might call the ultimate everyday adventurer. When times are tough, a lot of people pull back on travel, but Mason is going great guns. He is embarking on an expedition to Antarctica this December.
I will probably by the end of it have spent about $12,000 or $13,000. I had to start a financial vehicle in the summer of 2008 and save for a year and a half basically to be able to pay for it, but I think it's well worth it.
He started a savings account and squirreled away $12,000 to $13,000 in a year. That's pretty good.
Year and a half. And you know, this is so much more to him than a vacation. This is the fulfillment of a lifelong dream. He's gonna be sleeping out on the ice, he's gonna be kayaking in, you know, these frigid waters. And most people, you know, only use this kind of a savings vehicle to start saving for a home or to pay off college debt. And it is really important to him that adventure be a part of his life. When we talk about the value in this series, we're not just talking about people who do service, which Mason also does, but people who fulfill their own quirky lifelong dreams. And I would say this is a quirky lifelong dream. What do you think?
So, yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, has he done this before? I mean, is this the first time he's done this kind of thing?
He is, excuse me, the consummate if it's there, I'll see it. He's gone paragliding in the Alps. He's been in the Galapagos Islands. We've got a picture on our site of him with this enormous turtle, hiking in Indonesia. He, in fact, has gone, you know, to most parts of the world already. And when I caught up with him last week, it was in Prospect Park in Brooklyn, hardly the most exotic location. But he was training for the New York City Marathon, which takes place this Sunday. And as you can see from the video we have at thetakeaway.org, he's not exactly one of those skinny little marathoner types. I asked him why he does all this.
Something I do for myself to take me out of my comfort zone and get me out and meet new people and do things that I'm not very good at, because I'm not very good at this stuff.
I would imagine that a lot of people who are struggling right now to make their bills would think it is absolutely insane to set aside $12,000 for a trip to Antarctica. What is he actually having to cut back on in order to be able to afford this?
Well, the thing that is quite remarkable about Mason, you know, in addition to the fact that he is so adventurous and he's also so, understated. The people in his running group didn't even know he was going on this big trip. He's not a bragger. He doesn't go around trying to say, I'm doing these cool things. But he's a saver. He comes from a Midwestern family that, has farm roots. And he is, in some ways, the most middle American, methodical person around. Instead of running up his cards to go on this big trip, he creates a savings plan. He does not eat out for lunch. He does not go to Starbucks. He buys his clothes and his home furnishing secondhand. So in some ways, he's a very frugal guy. You know, he's the kind of person who
except for his travel budget.
He's frugal so that he can live lavishly when he goes on these big adventures. And it really does, you know, point to certain trends where certain people in this economy are actually saying, not necessarily that they want to spend more, but they want to live their dreams because nothing is promised. But, you know, this will actually be the seventh continent that he has visited.
And I don't know that I set out with that in mind as a starting point, but it's there now. And I just think it's going to be so amazing. I think it's going to be so epic. And I want the experience for myself, and I want to be able to tell people firsthand, this is how it was.
So he's visited all seven continents, and did he tell you he had other plans?
Well, he will have visited all seven
after
once he does this trip
Antarctica.
In December. And, you know, one of the other things that you'll find out more about when you go check out the video online at thetakeaway.org, because, you know, for the value, we do a little video snippet, and then we do our conversation
here. Full-service multimedia destination.
Exactly, full-service multimedia. And we went to visit him in Prospect Park, and he does charitable races. You know, he raises money for leukemia and lymphoma, for MS, for AIDS, by doing team and training and the AIDS marathon. So a lot of his adventures also have to do with having gone around the world for a purpose that's larger than his own enjoyment. So there's this part of him that goes on these great adventures for himself, but then there's this part that does some of his adventures with groups in order to raise money to help other people. So it's integrated into his life. And this is really why this is the value for him. It is about internally who he is. He is someone who wants to see the world, explore the world, who puts a huge premium on being a part of the world. And I think that that's something that, you know, a lot of people want to do, but they say, I can't, I don't have enough money, this, that, or the other. Of course, everyone's circumstances are different, but Mason's life shows that if you are willing to plan and willing to be methodical and willing to skip your latte, you can achieve these huge dreams.
And if you want to meet Mason Scherzer and hear more about his story, for I went and spoke with him as he was training for the New York Marathon. You can see that video at the website. It's thetakeaway.org. Fry today, a takeaway correspondent who's hosting the Value series. Thanks so much. See you next time. And by the way, while we were talking, we got this story.
This is Todd. I'm a Boston Public Schools teacher. Every summer I save between $5,000 and $10,000 to go on various adventures. This last summer I took my dream adventure. I took a cruise boat down the Amazon where I slept in a hammock with about 100 other Brazilians just swinging through the Amazon breezes. And then I went in and explored the Amazon rainforest. I take second jobs at my work. I save my tax return money, and all that just goes straight into a savings account, and I have these adventures every single summer.
That's a really great story. I'm just trying to imagine him and 100 Brazilians in one hammock. Keep those stories coming. How much of a priority do you put on your special trips? What is your dream trip, and is it worth the money? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. But hopefully you have time for vacation, because the other thing we're asking you about is your office. Are you working more hours to make up for other employees who've been laid off? With fewer people in your workplace, are you ending up having longer weeks?
Hi, this is Anthony from New Jersey. We've actually gotten rid of a couple of people from my place of business, and I work a minimum of 12 hours daily now. And
oh, that hurts. Tell us your story at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. As always, we're always on here at The Takeaway. If you missed anything, go take our podcast to go. You can subscribe at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. We're always anxious to hear your stories about what's going on the ground where you are. Give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
The numbers are in. The GDP grew by more than 3% in the third quarter. That's right. The recession has officially ended. Or it could just be an arbitrary number that doesn't actually reflect the suffering of the unemployed during this seemingly never-ending jobless recovery. But we're not going to think about that. The recession is over. I just want to celebrate. Time to celebrate. Or not on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 29th. I'm Celeste Headlee. John Hockenberry is out sick today. Coming up, the House leadership is going to, with great ceremony, unveil the brand new health care overhaul bill. What's in it? We don't know, but Todd Zwillick may have more details for us. We're also going to learn how cell phones can be used to combat corruption in Afghanistan. But first, let's go to Rick Holguin. He joins us from El Dorado Hills, California. Rick, you're the owner of a small business called Latinos for Hire. So tell me, for you, is the recession over?
Well, I know they just announced those numbers, but in the last half hour, we really haven't seen a big spike in revenue here. So the recession still isn't over, but it does give us optimism and hope when we see those numbers.
Okay. Also joining us, Rhoda Quick from Minneapolis. Rhoda, you were laid off in May from your job as a legal assistant. What do you think? For you, Rhoda, is the recession over?
Well, I checked my email, I checked my job boards, and I checked my cell phone. No changes.
No, the GDP numbers not swaying you.
Not yet.
We stay with us. We're going to talk more in just a few moments. But first, everything you need to know this morning. In the headlines, continuing with economic news, we also just learned there was 530,000 new applicants for unemployment benefits last week. That's fewer than analysts expected. That's a drop. President Obama made a surprise overnight visit to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. He was there to pay his respects to the bodies of 18 U.S. service members who died in Afghanistan last week. It was the president's first trip to the Dover Air Base, the main point of entry back to the U.S. for service members who've died in battle. In Washington, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is expected to unveil the latest version of the House health care bill today. A vote in the full chamber could be held by the end of next week. That's separate from the bill that is forming in the Senate right now. Overseas, Iraq has arrested more than 60 members of its own security force over the bombing Sunday that left more than 150 people dead. The government did not say if those detained were suspected of being involved in the explosions or if it was over negligence in carrying carrying out their duties in protecting Baghdad. And in sports, the Philadelphia Phillies won Game 1 of the World Series last night, trampling the New York Yankees 6-1. Game 2 is tonight. The Dow is going to open today at 97.63. It dropped about 1% yesterday. The S&P will kick off at 10.43, and the NASDAQ also dropped. It'll start trade at 20.60. So the economy is recovering, partly because businesses are, their labor costs are down. Are you working more hours because people have been laid off?
This is Barb from Detroit. I work for a marketing company, and in fact, I'm seeing people working less hours. We work with the automotive industry. It's been creeping up so quickly, the amount of hours that people have been working, that people are actually starting to work less hours now because I think they just say, I can't take it anymore. What's the point? And I might lose my job anyway.
No, 8778-MY-TAKE, or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Good stories.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Well, we've been in the worst recession since the 1930s, but as of, say, 35 minutes ago, the GDP numbers came out, and it's done. It's over. But does it really feel like that on the ground?
Hi, this is Mimi, and if the recession really is over, could someone please tell Detroit, because we are still hurting very much here.
I think there's hurting going on all over the country right now, actually. So let's go to Mike Munger, economist at Duke University. Good morning, Mike. Do we have Mike?
Good morning.
There you are, Mike. Yep. you're in stunned amazement over the GDP numbers, and you couldn't speak. Right?
We're tired. All the economics faculty are out in the hallway doing the antler dance.
I don't even want to know what the antler dance is.
Right.
No, I don't want to know. But these numbers are better than expected, right?
They may be better than expected. I mean, I'd like to think that middle schoolers all over the United States are texting each other, OMG, it's GDP. But I'm not sure
be that. Not so much, Mike. Or not.
If you look at the categories, GDP is gross domestic product, and
right.
It's the sum of three things. It's how much are consumers spending, how much are businesses investing, and how much is government spending. All of this is government. All of this increase was the cash for clunkers, the subsidies for home purchases,
the first time home buyers, right?
Yeah, right, and a few other things. Very little of it is consumers, and very little of it is investment by businesses. So this is nice, but it's fake in terms of an actual upturn.
Well, I think Rhoda Quick would probably agree with you. Rhoda Quick, laid off from her job in May as a legal assistant. She joins us from Minneapolis. Rhoda, you have not seen any signs of you haven't gotten a break from this recession, right?
Not quite yet.
What has been going on? How has your job search been going? Have you gotten interviews?
I have been painfully looking for work since May. I go to about 20 different job sites. I'm at 7 different employment firms and about 3 different temp firms, and they just don't have anything.
And you're in foreclosure proceedings on your house?
I'm going into month 3 of not being able to pay.
And you have you're a single mother of a 13-year-old daughter?
That's correct. And I tried to explain to her what the GDP was, and she had the bewildered look like I did.
So, see there, Mike? There's a 13-year-old who's not texting, oh my, OMG GDP. Rick Holguin also joins us. He's the owner of the recruitment firm called Latinos for Hire out of El Dorado Hills, California. Rick, your firm actually sets up recruiting events for Fortune 1000 companies.
That's correct.
But you've had to lay off the vast majority of your staff, well over half of them.
Yes, over the last several years, we've been also in a steady layoff mode, like the steady decline of the economy.
And you know, one of the things that we've been asking our listeners all day is whether or not the remaining employees after layoffs, whether or not the remaining employees end up having to work more hours. Is that true in your office?
Oh, for sure. For a while there, we were working, 8-hour days, and just slowly we went from 9 hours to 10 hours to 11 hours to now 12-hour days.
That's a long day, Mike Munger. Is this typical that businesses are becoming more profitable because they've laid people off?
Well, the way that it often works at the bottom of a recession is that companies start to make profits because they've laid people off, and that means that productivity goes up, output per worker, because the people who are left are working harder. But that gives the businesses something to invest. Once they start investing, of the business gets a little bit bigger. They start hiring people back. It does seem kind of heartless, but that's how things start to turn around.
It does seem very heartless that Wall Street is making money off of people who've been laid off. But talk to Rhoda Quick real quick, because she hasn't been able to find any real job prospects since May. How long do you think she has before these businesses stop enjoying this extra productivity and start hiring people like her again?
Well, economists make themselves feel better by naming things. And so we name some of this kind of employment frictional, and some of it structural. The frictional employment is people are laid off, but in their area, they're going to be able to find new jobs. The real problem is structural unemployment in cities where the unemployment rate is so high and so many businesses have moved out. It's not clear that things are going to get better without pretty substantial action, perhaps by the government.
Rhoda, are you and your friends? I mean, I'm sure you have other friends who've been laid off as well. Has anyone that you know been getting work there in Minneapolis?
Actually, no. A few have decided to go back to college, but me being a single parent, it's a little hard with the time restraints of college. So I'm just riding the wave, and not only with my house, but with the job search, and just hoping that my future has something bright.
You heard Mike Munger, an economist at Duke University, saying that this could possibly, these GDP numbers possibly mean we've hit bottom. I'm wondering, how long do you and your daughter have? How much longer do you have before you really, really have to find a job?
Not too much longer. I've used up my savings. I've cashed out part of my 401k. And like I said, I'm on my third month of not affording my home. So I don't know what the future holds, but it does not look good.
Is your daughter also getting this feeling of anxiety from you?
Yes, we both have had many sleepless nights.
Oh. Rick Holguin, you're hearing this conversation, and you heard Mike Munger talk about possibly we're at the bottom. I'm wondering that in your events, your recruiting events for these Fortune 1000 companies, what have you seen in terms of layoffs? I mean, have there been deep cuts in staff?
There definitely has been. We've seen, again, a decline of the Fortune 1000 companies that we're used to working with, whereas maybe 80% of them were hiring a couple years ago. Maybe 15% of that same group was hiring this past year. So, I mean, the upside is the 15% out there that are the industries that are recruiting, like healthcare and some of the other service industries. They do have, you know, good jobs. It's just that the numbers, you know, there's just so many companies not hiring. You know, it makes it tough for the job seeker out there.
And Rick, I'm wondering, you heard Rhoda saying she's pretty much out of time. How much longer do you have before maybe you could think about hiring someone again? Are you even in that thought process?
Sure. We are not in that thought process. The way we operate is we try and sell as much of our services as possible. And when we see business pick up and when we have the revenue in the bank and the cash in the bank, and when we think it's time to take a chance, then that's when we will move. But right now, we just don't see the increase in business yet to be able to do something like that.
Mike Munger, for people like Rhoda who've been laid off, and believe me, I understand what Rhoda is going through. I myself was laid off for 6 months. That's a tough thing, and it's difficult for people to hear economists cheering on Wall Street, and their bills are piling up on their desk, and they're in danger of losing their homes. What kind of what economic measures do we look for that are actually going to make a difference in our own homes?
Well, the GDP is an aggregate sort of concept. That means it's a whole bunch of things put together. The reason I think people might start to cheer is that things are going to start getting better in a few months. The problem before was things were getting worse. As long as things are still getting worse, then there's more and more people in the position that Rhoda's finding herself. The question is, have there been such big structural changes in the economy that there are large areas, Ohio, Minnesota, Michigan, where the jobs are never going to come back? That would be really the sad thing, if there's just fundamental changes in communities that aren't going to change at all, even if the aggregate economy starts to come back overall.
And we don't know that yet, whether they are structural.
That's right. And we won't know it for some time. And it's hard to know what sort of actions the government might take, because as it stands, well, cash for clunkers, 700,000 cars were sold, but only probably 125,000 of those would not have been sold anyway. So it's very expensive for taxpayers. We may need some sort of more radical action But it's hard to know what. And none of it's very popular because of the deficit. We're stuck. We're really stuck in a hard place.
And in the fourth quarter GDP, without the cash for clunkers and with maybe fewer people taking advantage of the homebuyer credit, will we see a 3.5% increase? That's another question. Rhoda, go ahead.
The question is whether we can prime the pump, whether this sort of primed the pump and whether it'll start back up from this point or whether it was a one-time thing that we'll look back on and say, no, it didn't matter.
Rhoda, quick, you were laid off in May, and clearly it's been months and months and months. Have you gotten interviews?
I've had 4 interviews and 2 second interviews, but the first one was while I was still working, and I was obligated to stay until my time was up, so I had to decline that one. And the second one said I didn't have enough experience, and I have over 25 years of experience. So I guess the employers can pick and choose what they want because they have a large pool to choose from.
Well, it's a tough sell having a celebration for you and your daughter today, Rhoda Quick, in Minneapolis, but I wish you the best of luck in your job search. We already also heard from Rick Holguin. He's the owner of a recruitment firm called Latinos for Hire. His firm sets up recruiting events for Fortune 1000 companies. He joined us from California. And Mike Munger is an economist at Duke University. Thank you to all of you. So despite the GDP numbers, workers are still asking workers to do more with less. Is that you?
My name is Ammon. I'm calling from Salt Lake City. I work the graveyard shift at a print shop, and we're understaffed. Nobody else wants to work. When the other graveyard person goes on vacation this week, I've worked 70 hours, just 7 days a week, because there's no one else to work for them.
Give us your story at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Hey, you want that to go?
That's right. We've got your news to go. Some quick takeouts now on stories we're following this week. We go to Todd Zwillick first. He's the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. So, Todd, everyone's talking about what could possibly be in this health care bill that the House Democrats are going to unveil with great pomp and circumstance. What details do we have?
Yeah, a lot of pomp and circumstance for not a lot of detail yet. And members, a lot of members don't know what's in it either. What we do know is that the robust public option that Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic leadership have said all along that they want, it's not in there. This is a sort of what a Democrat would probably think is a weaker public option based on negotiated rates. That means the government would negotiate with doctors and hospitals, just like insurance companies do now. You don't save as much money, and it probably doesn't cover as many people. So the liberals in the Congress, many of whom said they would never support a public option that wasn't the strongest one, will be probably pretty upset about this. And also, you have to look at the Senate very quickly, because Harry Reid's bid for a public option over there is not garnering 60 votes yet. So people over there are talking about triggers and various things to make it more palatable. And the Progressive Caucus, which has 80 votes, is saying that'll never fly. So listen to Lynn Woolsey of California. She's the leader of the progressives. Here's what she has to say about weakening the public option.
You'll hear from us that there will be no votes from progressives, the Black Caucus, the Hispanic Caucus, and the Asian Caucus, that there will not be enough votes to pass any trigger.
You know, what's odd here, Todd, is that they're all preparing themselves to either be pleased or offended. Like, they don't know what's in the bill, but they're just, like, reacting to what they don't know about.
Well, so many people have taken such strong positions on this. You know, people will be a little more flexible in the end than they say they'll be now, because people have to take strong positions. But when it comes to casting your vote, yay or nay, be a little more flexible.
Right. And the Democratic leaders, as we said, lots of pomp and circumstance, lots of ceremony, and they're planning a big celebration.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because we don't know exactly how much this bill is going to cost. They won't say. We don't know yet how many people it will cover, and we don't know exactly who pays in terms of taxpayers and rates and insurance companies and drug companies and everything else. And members were asked last night to appear next to the speaker and the Democratic leadership for this big kind of press conference-y TV event, even though some of them don't know if they're backing the bill. Marion Barry is a congressman, a former pharmacist from Arkansas. He hasn't decided if he's backing the bill, but he was asked last night to appear at this press conference, and it's a little ironic, and here's what he had to say about that.
I think that's standard operating procedure. I'm not very smart, but I wasn't born last night, and, you know, You do, especially when you get to this point, you do what you got to do.
Okay, well, what they got to do is unveil this healthcare bill so we know what's in it. Todd Zwillick is the Takeaways Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd. Let's go down to business with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. And Louise, you have a story today about credit cards. There was a Pew Health Group's Safe Credit Cards project. They issued a report yesterday. And what they found here, this is surprising. We have the Credit Card Act that they passed, which is going to go into effect in late February. And that's going to really tighten up the restrictions on what credit card companies can do. How many banks at this point are in full compliance with the Credit Card Act?
Well, the report, Celeste, was entitled Still Waiting. And I think it's worse than still waiting, because we're not just waiting for change. What the report found is that it's been getting worse. It's flabbergasting. A number of these banks in between December and July raised their rates. They started doing these things where if you index rates on credit cards to an index of rates, you could raise them. If you miss a single payment, they'll just start spiraling your rate upwards. And what it looks like to me is that a number of banks are trying to rip consumers off as much as they can right now, this fall, before they're not allowed to next February. And this has made people in Congress so upset that you've seen the House Financial Services Committee propose a bill to make this bill go in, make this bill from last spring go into effect in December to speed it up. And you just saw Chris Dodd in the Senate this week come out and say, we've got to freeze credit card interest rates right now. So they recognize that the banks aren't rushing to get better. They're rushing to rip people off while they still can.
Are the banks justifying their actions?
You know, what's so interesting to me is that we've been covering how banks have been publicly talking about how they're stopping overdraft fees on the checking accounts. And so it seems like on the one hand, and part of the banks, they're trying to look really good and do nice things for consumers. But in this other corner of the company, in the credit card area, they're trying to pull in the money as much as they can before the bill goes into effect. You know, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, has said with this new law and with what's going on with credit card losses, he doesn't see their credit card division being profitable until 2011. So you've got a lot of banks that are really nervous that when this law starts, they're not going to be able to make profits and they're not going to be able to charge these sky-high interest rates, so they're doing it now.
So there's our takeaway from Louise Story of the New York Times. The banks are ripping people off while they can. That's horrifying. Let's go to sports now with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway Sports contributor. You predicted that a lot of runs would be scored. They were. But it didn't turn out to be the runs that you thought they would be, right? And A-Rod struck out three times. Philadelphia beat the New York in Game 1 of the 2009 World Series. 6-1 was the final score. What happened?
So the whole story is really all about Chase Utley, but really it's about Cliff Lee. Cliff Lee scored. He didn't score anything, actually. He just made it look extremely easy. There was one pop-up fly where he just like nonchalantly just put his hand out. It's like he was playing catch with his kids. There was another one where there was a line drive and he did a spin around and he caught the ball kind of behind his back.
He was enjoying himself.
He does not get nervous, and his nervousness makes him more calm, more relaxed. Like he's just out there playing a nonchalant game, relaxed. The shutout. It was almost a shutout going into the ninth inning when Jeter got on base and then Johnny Damon got on base. And because of a Jimmy Rollins error, the Yankees scored a run. There was nothing that Cliff Lee did to get them. He had no earned runs. His ERA is now .55 going into this next game. So this is the thing. Cliff Lee was outstanding. He pitched literally one of the best baseball games ever in a World Series that you'll ever see. People are comparing him to Don Larson, who pitched a perfect game before. People are comparing him to Bob Gibson, who pitched an unbelievable game in the 60s. There was no performance like this that you could ever imagine. He completely baffled the Yankee hitters. There was some other stuff that I want to say. In terms of some historical perspective, the 1996 Yankees, they won the World Series in 1996 after a long drought. They lost Game 1 and Game 2 in Yankee Stadium to the Braves.
That's what you're pinning your hopes on.
My hopes? No. I'm pinning the hopes of 24 million in the greater New York area. All the Mets fans that have decided that they're going to root for the Yankees in lieu of their hatred of the Philadelphia Phillies.
We'll see if the Phillies can repeat their success. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is the Takeaway Sports contributor. Thanks, Ibrahim.
Hey, thanks. Good morning.
problem in Afghanistan, widespread corruption throughout the government. The solution? Blackberries and cell phones. We're going to talk about that more in just a few minutes. But first, let's check in with Femi Oke on some of the news stories that we're following at 32 minutes past the hour.
And good morning. A government report out this morning indicates that the recession has ended. The economy grew at a 3.5% pace in the third quarter. That's the best showing in 2 years. That growth was fueled by government-supported spending on cars and homes. Meanwhile, a separate report finds that the number of people claiming first-time jobless benefits dropped by 1,000 to 530,000 last week. Analysts expected a larger decline. Moving overseas, U.S. officials say that China has agreed to lift a ban on American-U.S. pork imports. The ban was imposed last spring because of H1N1 concerns. Back at home, President Obama made a surprise visit to Delaware's Dover Air Force Base early this morning. He was there to honor 18 American service members killed in Afghanistan. He also met with families of the fallen troops. His visit comes during the deadliest month for U.S. forces since the war began. House Democrats are planning to unveil a revised version of their health care bill. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says that she wants to get the measure on the House floor next week with a final vote by Veterans Day in November. And finally, in sports, the Phillies play the New York Yankees in the Bronx tonight for Game 2 of the World Series. Last night, the Phillies defeated the Yankees 6-1. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Talk again and again on this program about how we need to fight corruption in Afghanistan in order to maintain a legitimate, credible government in Kabul, a government then that can collect taxes, deliver services, and have the infrastructure to do basic things like pay its employees reliably. But that's been a problem in Afghanistan, and for many people, fighting corruption now has a very distinctive sound, and that sound of fighting corruption may be familiar to you. That's right. The sound that annoys you when you're in the movie theaters is now the tool for fighting corruption in Afghanistan. Joining us to explain this is David Loyne. He's the BBC's veteran foreign correspondent. He's the author of the book, In Afghanistan, 200 Years of British, Russian and American Occupation. Good morning, David.
Hi, Celeste. Well, it's certainly something that the British never tried when they were there in the 19th century, because this is an absolutely 21st century idea. It's technology jumping 2 centuries, really.
How does it work? How does the cell phone help you combat corruption?
Well, where they're trialling this, and they've tried it with 53 police officers so far, it's very, very early days, but it's very popular with the guys that they've tried it with. Up until now, if you're a police officer in Afghanistan, you earn characteristically an average of about $200 a month. And now, up until now, that money has been stolen by people all the way down the line. So the police officer in the field gets about 100, because the chief of police and the people from the interior ministry and then his sergeant take the money. So the salary, by the time it gets to him, may be half of what it started out at. If he can, as he can now, just put a SIM number in his mobile phone at the end of every month, suddenly he gets the $200. It appears there in his mobile phone, and then he can go to a mobile phone shop, or when this works in the longer term, to just other shops, other retail outlets, and say, put the SIM number in. They check that SIM number on their mobile phone. Mobile phone technology works in Afghanistan, and he takes the money out. It's like a bank in a country where 97% of people don't have bank accounts.
So here's Altaf Ladak. He's the COO of Roshan, the mobile phone company that's actually piloting this, talking about exactly that $70 and what a big difference that makes.
If today they can receive $200, instead of $130, that's a significant change on corruption, that's a significant change on the money that is getting to the community and the economic development.
So $70 doesn't seem like that much, David Loyne, but when we're able to multiply it?
If it's up to half of your income, it's a huge amount. And I think there might be some element of getting people to, do you trust your mobile phone? But once it works, once you see that it's worked, they've already carried out tests in microfinance for small farmers, for loans for farmers on mobile phones in Afghanistan. And then, of course, it's popular because all of the money's there. In the same way, people are remitting money from one side of the country to another. again, there's a big security element in this as well, because police officers and indeed anyone who earns any money in Afghanistan wants to take some of that cash back to their families. So they have to travel. Security is difficult. They might get robbed along the way. They take time off work when they travel. And all of those things could be prevented if you just phone up your mum in northern Afghanistan and say, here's a SIM number. You can take out $20 from my mobile phone account. Then we call it banking, but it's something that's not existed in Afghanistan up to now.
What if someone steals your mobile phone? Do they then have access to your cash?
I think it's like you have the number. You have the personal ID.
It's like our ATM card PIN number.
Exactly like a PIN number. We call it a PIN number. Exactly that. And so as long as you keep that, it's like if somebody steals your credit card and you keep the PIN number with it, then you're lost. But providing you keep those two apart. And I think the really interesting thing is that this is private industry making this work, that Roshan, the mobile phone company in Afghanistan, has been successful in spreading mobile phones. Normal, you don't have to be very wealthy to have a mobile phone in a country like Afghanistan. They don't have landlines, but they do have mobile phones. With a little bit of international support, in fact, coming from USAID in terms of putting the technology into place, saying how this has worked in some places in Africa. You know, in the middle of Africa, you can get crop prices on your mobile phone now, right in the middle of nowhere. And that has transformed the relationship of farmers to markets. And in the same way, I think this could make a revolutionary change in Afghanistan.
So, David Loyne, I have to ask, is this going to make it easier for members of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda to transfer money to them, to other branches?
I guess it could. Absolutely. They have mobile phones as well. They use them. When I've traveled with the Taliban, they use their mobile phones a huge amount. They don't seem to mind whether they're being listened to. I think they think that if they bombard anyone listening to them with calls and two-way radios, then absolutely, I guess they could move money around the country. But Afghanistan is a country which has been used in the past to trusting moneylenders, because they don't have traditional banks. They have a system called Havala, which has existed in the past, where, and I've used it, get somebody to put money in London and then walk up to a money changer in the market down in Kabul, where it's really dusty and you wouldn't think that there's any sort of technology, and you give the man a code number and he gives you the money. So this Havala system has worked in the past, and in fact they're calling this a mobile phone Havala. Celeste, the town I went to where I talked to people about how the mobile phone system is working felt like a pioneer town. It didn't feel like the Taliban were in control there.
Well, and if it works, David, it's going to be great. David Loyne is the developing world correspondent with our partner, the BBC. He's also author of the book In Afghanistan, 200 Years of British, Russian and American Occupation. Coming up, the New York Times Magazine has an upcoming intimate but respectful story on the first couple's marriage. And we're going to learn more about the Obamas later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. So when Iggy Pop and the Stooges were playing tiny little dive bars around Detroit, they were anti-mainstream, they were edgy, they were anti-establishment, they broke the rules of pop music, they were completely unconcerned about social manners and decorum, and now they may be going into a museum. It's true. Iggy's been nominated for induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and they face some stiff competition from the likes of Kiss, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and ABBA? What? Tonight and tomorrow, many of the acts that started their careers in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s are going to perform at New York's Madison Square Garden to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But when you hear those cheap pieces of music, does that give you any idea of what rock and roll is supposed to be? I'm going to ask that question to our guest. Andy Langer is the music critic for Esquire magazine. He joins us from his home in Austin, Texas. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning.
So, first of all, you may know I recently came from Detroit, and I would probably not be allowed back within the city limits if I didn't mention the fact that Detroiters are still angry that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is in Cleveland.
Well, it had to be somewhere, and I'm not sure why Cleveland, but they did pick Cleveland.
Okay.
The beautiful IMP building.
It is what it is. But, you just heard those two examples of music there. With these inductions into the Hall of Fame, are they giving us any kind of definitive description of what rock and roll is supposed to be?
Well, I mean, the idea of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is to, what, document, archive, create a narrative, a history of rock and roll. And I think for a lot of the early years, absolutely. I mean, because they had, you know, 50 years to choose from when they started this 25 years ago. You had Elvis, you had Barry, you had Ray Charles, and now they're up to Metallica and Grandmaster Flash and, like we said, the Stooges and potentially Kiss or even LL Cool J. So, you know, it definitely covers or needs to cover a lot of ground, and there's always going to be debate. I mean, any kind of Hall of Fame, whether it's the Baseball Hall of Fame or the Hockey Hall of Fame or whatever, people, you know, music fans are a lot of ways like sports fans. They like to debate. They feel passionate about the things, the bands they're passionate about, and it's going to lead to debate.
But, you know, it's kind of arbitrary, don't you think? I mean, this really is kind of a museum that came up with the inductions into the Hall. The only reason it's called a Hall of Fame is because people wouldn't go to Cleveland to go to the Rock and Roll Museum, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Hall of Fame, the argument starter that it is definitely arbitrary. In fact, it's a secret panel that creates the nominee list, and then there's a bunch of rock critics that you know, and music industry types who vote on it. But yeah, it's absolutely arbitrary, but so is every Hall of Fame, and any museum that has a quote Hall of Fame attached to it is designed as an argument starter in a lot of ways.
Well, I think our Jay in our control room would like to meet the secret panel and ask them why Genesis is not included in the Hall of Fame yet, but or why it took them so long to get in there. But I imagine that there's a lot of groups that are not in the Hall of Fame that people feel passionate that they should be there.
Yeah, I mean, personally, for instance, I live in Austin, Texas, and Stevie Ray Vaughan is probably one of the, what, five greatest
there
guitarists of all time and pretty much agreed upon as such. He's not even on the ballot. So it's a bizarre, you know, system of who gets on the ballot and who doesn't. There's been accusations that they're just trying to build the best television show possible. And in a lot of ways, I think that might be true.
That might be true. Andy Langer is the music critic for Esquire. Thanks, Andy. Good morning, I'm Celeste Haley. John Hockenberry is out sick today. Coming up, we're going to get an intimate look inside the White House at the marriage between Michelle and Barack Obama, and they have some important advice for young couples. More on that in a few minutes. We're also talking about your job today. Lots of people have been laid off, millions of unemployed people across the country, and does that mean you're working more hours to make up for them?
I work for a religious school, and we are not being paid. Every payroll is a scramble. Last year, they ended up owing their teachers 3 months' salary. So we are in very severe straits.
Tell us your job story at 8778-MY-TAKE. Send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, let's go to Femi Okeh. She's got a check on leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour.
Thanks, Celeste. It is official. The U.S. is out of the recession and now is in a phase of recovery. Earlier this hour, we went to the Duke University economist Mike Munger for his reaction to the news.
OMG, it's GDP.
Yes, that's what he thought that middle schoolers would be texting each other earlier on this morning. Who knew that economists had a sense of humour and were smart? The new GDP estimates out this morning say that the economy grew at a 3.5% rate in the third quarter. That's the best showing in 2 years. Meanwhile, the number of people who applied for unemployed benefits last week is down slightly to 530,000 claims. That's fewer than analysts expected. President Obama made a surprise overnight visit to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, and he was there to pay his respects to the bodies of 18 U.S. service members who died in Afghanistan this week. And that's a look at some of the big stories we're following this morning.
The president and first lady spend a fair amount of time in public, I think that's safe to say, and it's also easy to see their carefully cultivated public persona that's on display. What's far more rare is to get a peek into what they're like together off camera. Listen to part of a recording made by New York Times reporter Jodi Kantor when she interviewed both of them about their marriage. You're a fly on the wall in the Oval Office.
Clearly, Barack's career decisions are leading us. That's obvious. You know, I'm married to the president of the United States.
You're listening to the president and the first lady, and they're sitting there in the Oval Office, and they're talking about their marriage.
I don't have another job, and it would be problematic in this role. But in terms of, you know, how we run our household, how I feel in my marriage, whether my voice is heard on a whole range of issues, mm-hmm. to me, that's equality.
That is, of course, Michelle Obama giving us a very rare, very candid glimpse into the dynamics that go on behind closed door at the White House. Jody Cantor is a national reporter for our partners, the New York Times, and she writes about this in the upcoming weekend's New York Times Magazine, where she explores how America's first family balances their work and their marital responsibilities. Jody stopped by our studios yesterday, and when we spoke, I pointed out that in reading her piece, the amazing thing I realized is that for the Obamas, the entrance into the White House marked the end of a period of chaos where the couple was rarely together.
Absolutely. The clock was always ticking. Did they have 15 minutes? Did they have an hour? Did they have a day before the president had to disappear again to Springfield, to Washington, to the campaign trail? This is actually the first time since 1996 that the Obamas have lived together full time.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. And it's wild because, I mean, having been married myself for quite a few years, not as long as the Obamas, I don't believe, but we have kids about the same age as their daughters. You know, to have that experience like that, I would think suddenly you got this big house, you'd go, hey, who are you? I mean, did right. they do some getting acquainted?
I think there was a period of adjustment. I think one of the adjustments and one of the differences between a legislative and an executive position is that when you're in a legislature, whether it's at the state or the national level, you're never really in control. A session can go until whatever clock in the morning, it can go over the weekend. Whereas when you're in an executive position, you're very, very busy, but you have a whole staff of schedulers who are in control of your schedule.
Right.
Now, you know, observing a presidential marriage, I don't imagine it's terribly spontaneous. I would think that there's staff and you have to
orchestrate the whole
thing.
You mean between the two of them?
Well, no, I mean just in the whole idea of interviewing the first, Michelle Obama and Barack Obama. But, I mean, can you tell that they're in love? I mean, can you tell that they're pretty close? I mean, do you have a sense of their chemistry?
Well, I did not need to go to the Oval Office to sense their chemistry, because one of the things that is distinctive about them as a presidential couple is how affectionate they are with each other. Mm. You know, when you go to White House events, and I think people see this on TV and in photographs too, they touch each other a lot. They flirt. They kiss. And so one of the things I was trying to figure out with the story is, why do they do that? Because even sometimes people who are very much in love don't do that. And by the end of the story, what I really wondered was whether it was about two people who were in a new and very unfamiliar situation, almost clinging to each other a little bit.
Hmm.
I almost feel, though, you know, I'm torn every time I hear about the Obama marriage, because part of me, I like these people, especially as a couple, on a certain level, and I'm interested in kind of getting that kind of insider view in the White House. And the other part of me is like, you know, I don't want to know. You know, I don't want to know. This is their private life. You know, so much of a politician's life is completely open to the public, and they should be able to reserve some of it all to themselves.
Well, they taught that became part of the story. And I have to say, I thought about that a lot. I did not want to cast this story as secrets of the Obama marriage revealed. Instead, it's really looking at a political partnership and how that partnership has changed and fluctuated over the years, because that does have an impact on the rest of us. And also, there's a public fascination sure. with this marriage that I was noticing from readers, and I wanted to be able, I've covered the Obamas for a couple of years now. I had some ideas about
why we're so fascinated by this?
Yes, match? But in the interview, so when I sat with the Obamas in the Oval Office, one of the things that was interesting about the interview was that line between them wanting to share and not wanting to share, because they're extraordinarily comfortable with being role models. They pretty much said that the reason they were doing the interview was that they did not want people to think that their marriage was perfect. They wanted to set an example of talking about marriage in a frank way. They answered, you know, questions very gamely. And yet there were times when they drew a line. And the president in particular also complained in a very diplomatic way about some of what had happened to their marital life.
In the course of being president or in the course of being a candidate and being Barack Obama?
President in particular, at the end of the interview, he gave what was pretty much a soliloquy about what we think of as the famous Obama date nights. And we're used to seeing them on TV, and right. we're used to seeing them looking very glamorous and very happy. And it turns out that things were a little bit more complicated than that. They had kind of the date night from hell back in New York last spring. They came to New York for dinner and a show. Right. The president had promised the first right. lady this on the campaign. And what happened is that the Republicans attacked them for using federal money right. on their own entertainment. And what the president was very upset about was that his outing with his wife had become an occasion for political debate over use of federal money.
Hmm. How do you get a sense of the quid pro quo here? It seems to me that the public profile of Michelle Obama is starting to emerge, and that I get a sense that she's going, okay, pal, it's my turn here, and that they're negotiating that in some way. Do you get a sense that that's going on?
Well, they negotiate everything. You know, other friends and White House aides say that they're extremely direct with each other. And so I think there is an ongoing conversation. And the most interesting question I think I ask them is I ask them whether it's possible to have an equal marriage when one member is president. And I don't know if you noticed that in the story, but it was a real moment. The president took about four tries at answering it. And finally, his wife
said, let me be careful here, right?
Yeah, yeah. And he yeah. made kind of a joke. And then his wife almost gallantly came in and tried to answer the question because it is unanswerable. Huh.
Is there a therapist in the picture?
I did ask them. We talked a little bit about this period of tension they had in their marriage that they've talked about before. The president wrote about it in Audacity of Hope. And I did ask them that. And what I would urge your listeners to do is go to nytimes.com, read the story, and see what you think of his answer. It's not a direct answer, but I think it does say something mm-hmm. about what they've been through and also what they're willing to say about their own marriage.
So you think this marriage has a future, at least through the first term?
Not only that, but you know what the historians say is that husbands and wives get closer in the White House. The presidency draws a marriage together. You have to work together. You can trust each other more than you can trust anybody else.
And as we certainly experienced, if it doesn't draw you together, it can certainly do the opposite.
Yes, yes. Although, you know, Valerie Jarrett argues that their marriage grew stronger during the campaign as well, which was a probably even more stressful time than their White House time. And she said it was because they had to work at it.
Our guest was Jodi Kantor, national reporter for our partner, the New York Times, in an interview recorded yesterday. Jodi's profile of the Obamas' marriage is in the New York Times Magazine. It's coming out this Sunday. So we've been collecting your stories. Keep them coming. The economy is recovering partly because businesses are saving money on labor costs, which means they're making you guys work more hours.
My name is Jack. Don't know if you take farmers' comments or not, but I am working a lot longer now. I live down in Virginia. I had to let go two guys who used to been with me for about 15 years, and we're working a lot longer now. We're not making nearly as much.
Why would we not take farmers' stories? Keep them coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org, and let us know your stimulus job stories. Have you gotten a job because of the stimulus package? We want to hear from you. 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.